Welcome to the historic Ocean House, a luxurious hotel that pays homage to New England's golden age of hospitality. With timeless elegance and renewed civility, this treasured resort is the setting for our special broadcast of the Ocean House Author Series. Each program features nationally best-selling and award-winning authors in a salon-style conversation, hosted by Ocean House owner, actress, and best-selling author, Deborah Goodrich Royce. WCRI is pleased to partner with the Ocean House to present this ongoing series, which brings you the best and the brightest of the literary world. Now, let's take you to the Ocean House.
Welcome, everyone, humans and fur friends alike. My name is Lindsay Makowicki. A few things to go over before we begin. This event is being recorded by WCRI for future broadcasts and podcasts. We'll ask that you silence your cell phones and we'll manage our expectations about our fur friends here because... So with that, it's time for some introductions. Dr. Renee Alsaraf has created 4 different veterinary oncology practices and led 3 veterinary radiation facilities. She has performed numerous veterinary clinical trials, co-authored peer-reviewed journal articles, and has lectured both locally and on the national level. She lives in Montclair, New Jersey, and is married to a veterinary ophthalmologist. They have 1 son whom she cherishes, as well as Dusty, her beloved bossy 6-year-old female boxer. Welcome, Dr. Renee.
Thank you.
Dr. Renee will be in conversation with Deborah Goodrich Royce. Deborah's thrillers examine puzzles of identity. Reef Road hit Publisher Weekly's bestseller list, Good Morning America's top 15 list, and was an Indie Next pick by the American Booksellers Association for January 2023. Ruby Falls won the Zibby Award for Best Plot Twist in 2021, and Finding Mrs. Ford was hailed by Forbes, Book Riot, and Good Morning America's Best of lists in 2019. She began as an actress on All My Children, and in multiple films before transitioning to the role of story editor at Miramax Films, developing Emma and early versions of Chicago and A Wrinkle in Time. With her husband Chuck, Deborah restored the Avon Theater, Ocean House Hotel, Deer Mountain Inn, United Theater, and numerous Main Street revitalization projects, both in Rhode Island and the Catskills. Dr. Renee and Deborah will now discuss her book, Sit, Stay, Heal, and after that, we will open it up to questions from the audience. For our friends listening on the radio, we want to capture your lovely questions, so if you raise your hand, I'll walk around with the microphone. And now, without any further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Renee Alsaraf and Deborah Goodrich Royce.
Thank you, Lindsay. Hi, this is extraordinary. So just for the benefit of people on the radio, we have lots of dogs of different sizes here. This is incredible. And then we're having a dog after party. I've never been to a dog after party, so I'm looking forward to it. So I'm so glad you're here. You are an Ocean House person, so you're often here, but I'm glad you're here in this capacity. So tell us, let's go way back. Let's start with kind of the dream. How did you become a veterinary oncologist?
So you guys can all hear me, yes? Mm-hmm. I have always wanted to be a veterinarian ever since I was 7 years old. And a lot of veterinarians have that same calling. For me, being a veterinarian is not even a job or a profession. It's my identity, right? It's how I identify myself. It's unusual, of course, to specialize or want to specialize in the treatment of cancer for animals. And even though that seems like such a sad topic, it is truly something that fills me back up. My father was a prominent medical oncologist in the human world, and so I don't know if somehow I had oncology in my blood, but when I was a sophomore veterinary student, I did an externship in New York City at the Animal Medical Center in oncology, and that really changed the trajectory of my career. At that time, I didn't realize that you could specialize and just do really one focus in veterinary medicine.
That's incredible. I didn't happen to have any scientifically inclined children, but if you do, all I can tell you is my dogs and cats have had ophthalmologists, cardiologists, the veterinary specialties, and I live in Greenwich, and right next to us in Stanford, Cornell has opened this incredible clinic, so you can see specialists on anything. And we do. Yes. That is, we love our animals. So you've tied in this book, the idea of working with, is it specifically only dogs? No, you work with cats as well.
Oh, so I work with dogs, cats. Yeah. I've treated 130-pound snake, ferrets, rabbits, birds. But for the sake of the book, what I did, actually, can I tell them how I started?
Everything.
Here we go.
Yes,
right.
We want to hear
because
this.
This actually goes
why
to
we're here.
An Ocean House story. So I always wanted to also be a writer or a book editor, but my whole world in life has been veterinary medicine, and then as a mom and a wife and, you know, volunteering in my community, I couldn't ever imagine also having the time to write a book. Unfortunately, in 2018, I was diagnosed with the C word. And I can say the word cancer for my patients, you know, talk to family members about people who have cancer, but it shows how dysfunctional I am, right? I could not and still cannot say that word for myself. And my veterinary technicians would say, Dr. A, that's not what the C word means, right? But for me, it did. I just couldn't own it. And for quite a long time, that C word, when I would say it and think it, had a capital C. And with time and lessons from our four-legged friends, that is now a lowercase C. So it took away its significance. It took away its power. At the time when I was first diagnosed and I went through radical surgery and 25 fractions of radiation and months of chemo, I didn't do any social media. But I realized it was too exhausting to always field a phone call or a text or an email of kind friends wanting to know how I was doing. So I decided to email what ultimately became 75 of my closest friends. And I'll tell you, if you ever get emails like that, answer them back, because the people who responded, even just a sentence or two of kind, loving, supportive words, they were my lifelines. I could go back and reread them. They gave me strength. But so many people also said, have you ever thought about writing a book? You really should write a book. I blew them all off. One of them is my son's friend's mother, because our house is where the boys always congregated, and I figured they needed to know if, you know, why Peter's mom was laying on the sofa not looking so good. And she happens to be a big literary agent in New York City. Malcolm Gladwell's her client, Elena Hildebrandt is her client, Seabiscuit. And she said, you really should write a book. And I blew them all off. Convalesced, got better. And then we came to the Ocean House. It wasn't our first time. My husband and I came just sort of as a reprieve. I was feeling better. And what I consider a silly luxury is you get that newspaper delivered to your hotel room door. And I always and only read two categories. The first is the comics, and the second is the horoscopes, right? The two most important part of the newspaper. And under Scorpio, my birthday that day, it said, you should begin writing your book today.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That's so specific.
Right. So specific.
Wow, don't take the M4 bus.
2 days later, I began writing. And I wrote a fair amount of it here.
So you have a birthday right about now.
Yeah, actually in 1 week.
Happy birthday.
Well, thank you.
So the book, each chapter, you really are looking at a particular dog. And talk about the general concept. How did you get into the concept of what the lessons you gleaned from your patients and how it applied to you?
So for those of you who aren't familiar with the book, every chapter is about a different dog patient of mine and either what that family learned from their dog or what I learned. And then woven through is my backstory. It is truly life lessons from dogs. And sort of to circle back to that previous question that you asked, when I originally sat down about writing this book, I had pages and pages of dog and cat and some ferret patients that had these life lessons that taught us. So I could have chosen so many others, but the ones I chose for the book really intertwined with where I was at that moment in my life. Every chapter is full of different life lessons, which we can certainly talk about. I think, though, the resounding overall lesson or theme is that dogs are not just incredible companions, but they are fantastic guides for when we struggle. And we all struggle at times. And how fortunate we are, right? We have that front row seat, or I hope that the book gives you that front row seat to the human-animal bond and how powerful it is in all of our lives.
So you went through your journey with cancer. You deal with dogs with cancer. What are the primary lessons? I mean, why don't you walk us through some of them?
Sure. Oh, okay. Where do you want to start? Here's one. Dogs are pack animals, right? They originally survived in the wild as pack animals. They each had a specific role. They relied on each other for protection, for hunting for food. They lay on each other for warmth and security. They were, in essence, their own weighted blanket. Do you remember the craze at Christmas or holiday time? In fact, just a couple of days ago, I was lecturing in North Carolina, and on Good Morning America, one of the things they were highlighting to purchase this year was a weighted blanket. Have you ever had a really bad day, and your dog comes up and lays alongside you, or even better, on you? Best feeling ever. Dogs have genetically evolved to be a part of our pack. Initially, thousands of years ago, right, they lived in our periphery, and they ate the little tiny shreds of meat that were left on the bones that we discarded. And then eventually, they helped us to hunt, to tend to flocks, to help us with protection. But emotionally, there was actually just one little mutation on a chromosome that genetically changed that made them a part of our emotional pact. And I know that my life is certainly a whole lot better for having dogs in it. But I also think if we take this thought or this concept out one step further, that we as people are so much better off as a pact, lifting each other up and helping each other. And so if we can take a cue from our four-legged friends, then we're that much better.
We'll take a short break and be back with the Ocean House Author Series here on WCRI.
If you have someone in your life that enjoys whiling away the hours by getting lost in the pages of a novel, why not present them with a book by hotelier, actress, and nationally best-selling and award-winning author Deborah Goodrich Royce? Start with Deborah's latest thriller, Reef Road, a Publisher's Weekly, Good Morning America, and American Booksellers Association pick. This true crime-inspired novel of suspense and high society in Palm Beach probes unhealed generational scars in a wrenching and original work of fiction. To learn more about the fascinating life and times of the author and her other page-turning mysteries, Finding Mrs. Ford and Ruby Falls, visit DeborahGoodrichRoyce.com.
And we're back with the Ocean House Author Series on WCRI.
I have three dogs in the house right now. I had four dogs in the house until yesterday. And one of the dogs is this weighted blanket dog. And not all of them do this, but this, I don't want to give this dog back to my daughter because he has this way of coming and sitting on me and increasing his body weight in the weirdest way. He's little. And suddenly I have this pressure and it's like, all right, I'm off the edge now. It's very strange.
Right.
Yeah. All right, give us another lesson.
Okay. Dogs are not judgmental, right? They have a whole host of emotions, happy, sad, excited, fear, but their stares will never be judgmental. Doesn't matter what your work performance was, if you had a misstep and put your foot in your mouth. And I think it's human nature for us to all be a little judgy. We're all a whole lot better off if we're not. I also know that I tend to have this voice inside my head. She's not always very nice to me. Actually, she's never very nice to me. But our dogs don't have that harsh critic. And when I was laying on the sofa with that straggly chemo hair and wearing my pajamas that I had had for 4 straight days and maybe a little bit of a chicken soup stain, my dog saw me for me, saw past the outward signs of chemotherapy. And, am I Kateri? That gave me the strength to fight hard and fight on because he saw me, and it gave me courage.
So. Yeah, absolutely. What about, so there are many people who don't have animals in their lives at all. I grew up with animals. Have anybody here not an animal person? You wouldn't be here, right? You're not here tonight. Those people are not here. And I am, we have a lot of grandkids, and some of them are raised with animals and some not. And it's just fascinating, the difference. And I think a life is only enriched by having animals at home. Sometimes I feel that I'm steeped in bodily fluids coming out of one area or another. But so what do you say to people who don't have animals? Same thing.
Oh, I don't know that they come up and talk to me.
Right.
Right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that they come up and talk to me. Speaking of bodily fluids, I had in one of the chapters is about Franny. She's a bloodhound. She unfortunately had a mast cell tumor in her stomach, which was very rare. She actually only had about 3 months to live. Spoiler alert, she lived for 6.5 years. She's done like more than great. But she was a search and rescue police dog. So her police partner would always bring her in, and she would shake her head, and the slobber would go flying. But she sort of had two different lessons. One is that as a pact, she and her police partner, the sum of what they could accomplish far exceeded what each individual could accomplish alone. Despite getting chemotherapy, and I know that the police captain was worried that her olfactory system, you know, her ability to smell wouldn't be good enough to find lost children or nab people on the run. She never missed a beat. She actually has a huge Facebook and social media following. She's great. So, better as a pact. But also, that girlfriend, if you will, started out at, I believe, 70 pounds, and through people feeling sorry for her, all the other officers down at the station with treats, she topped the scale at 121 pounds. She gained 50 pounds, right? And she was always looking for another biscuit or treat. Right? I, on the other hand, lamented because as part of my treatment, and I'm so blessed and thankful for everything and getting even to be here, but I gained a lot of weight, which was lymphedema. And here I fought every day to be alive, but I wasn't enjoying it because of the number on the scale or the size that my dress said. And Franny didn't have any of that. She's like, 50 pounds, I'm good, right? Where's the biscuit?
Well, that's like the lesson. They're not self-conscious. You see, a three-legged dog couldn't care less. We would be very complicated. How do
Correct.
I look?
Correct.
Yeah, that is one of the lessons. So when you decided to write this particular book and frame the human cancer journey against the canine or the animal cancer journey. Was that something you came up with as the concept on your own? Did your editor help you do that? How did it all, the structuring of it, how did you come up with that?
So I didn't have an editor, right? I was a no-name, first-time author, and Tina Bennett, who became my literary agent, had also said, you really should write this book. She's the Malcolm Gladwell, you know, person and all. And she said, I think that there would be a great juxtaposition between, and what she wanted me to do was write about the differences between veterinary medicine and human medicine. And I think just from the type of person I am, much more maybe emotional, wanted it less nonfiction-y, wanted it to be a little bit more about emotions and feelings and hopefully helping that. Two things with that. Someone who recently read it, she has a 5-year-old, very healthy Westie. She said that after she read the book, she felt that she was a better dog parent. She felt that she was a better person, and she felt much happier. So if the book can do that in this world, then I am thankful. I think, though, and again, I am so grateful for the care that I received, like truly, wouldn't be here without it. Sometimes the human medical field could take a nod from veterinary medicine, right?
So are the protocols the same?
Drugs are the exact same.
Yep. Really?
Radiation machine that we use is actually the exact same that is at, you know, the Mayo Clinic.
Really?
Yes.
And do dogs lose their hair?
90% of dogs do not lose their hair. No.
Fascinating.
So I actually use the dog as my recovery role model. They set the bar higher for me. Biologically, I think they're tougher than we are, right? If you think of a dog that has been spayed, the next day, even though she's not supposed to, she's trying to chase a squirrel in the backyard. Whereas for me, I had a hysterectomy, and I don't know if any of you know of someone who has, but we can't drive for a few weeks. I'm walked all hunched over. But I think it's so much more than that. I think that, I don't know if this is just mindfulness or that dogs use their energy in a positive way, which helps with healing. Before I would get chemotherapy, I would walk in, my tail was between my legs. I would lament for a week. You know, will they be able to hit my vein? Will I get sick? How sick is sick? And even after I was done, I thought, well, it took the nurse 3 tries to get the catheter in. What's going to happen the next time? Dogs come in, they're pulling at the end of the leash, they're sniffing, they're going to their neighbor to make another friend. And when they're done with chemotherapy, they hop up and they're looking for a biscuit. I do think, though, can you imagine, ladies, if every year when you go to the gynecologist, they give you some Godiva at the end of it? Maybe we would be a little happier about that, but it would help. I also think that the veterinarian honors that family dynamic. There's so much that goes into making that decision to treat. Finances, your ability to come back and forth, your level of risk tolerance, your nursing care that you would be able or willing to give. And I know at least for me with all of my doctors, they gave me one treatment path which we or I follow blindly, right? We don't necessarily do that in veterinary medicine. I think we often have to think outside of the box. But I think a good veterinarian understands that family, understands the motivation for them to treat, and it doesn't have to be cancer. It could be diabetes or kidney disease or what have you. And to not sit across from them, but to sit next to them, to help them make that decision. I don't know. That's, I think, what really good medicine is all about.
Has anybody treated a diabetic animal? I have. I had a diabetic cat for years. And they teach you with a stuffed animal. I don't know if they do that with humans, but they bring in a stuffed animal and you sit and you practice giving the injections. That's great. It was fabulous, and I learned how to do it. And it's amazing what you can do.
We'll take a short break and be back with the Ocean House Author Series here on WCRI.
If you have someone in your life that enjoys whiling away the hours by getting lost in the pages of a novel, why not present them with a book by hotelier, actress, and nationally best-selling and award-winning author Deborah Goodrich Royce? Start with Deborah's latest thriller, Reef Road, a Publisher's Weekly, Good Morning America, and American Booksellers Association pick. This true crime-inspired novel of suspense and high society in Palm Beach probes unhealed generational scars in a wrenching and original work of fiction. To learn more about the fascinating life and times of the author and her other page-turning mysteries, Finding Mrs. Ford and Ruby Falls, visit DeborahGoodrichRoyce.com.
And we're back with the Ocean House Author Series on WCRI.
Well, I think we should open this up to questions because it is such an important topic. I'm looking at my friend Marianne. You have had animals with health crises in the past. There's so much we do for our animals because there's so much they do for us. But I'd love to hear some of your questions on this topic before we have our after party.
I was wondering how you felt COVID affected the quality of treatment of ill animals when you're not able to be in the room with them, et cetera, et cetera.
So everyone heard that, right? How did COVID affect the quality of care for animals? It was horrible. On some level, it still is. It was horrible from every single person's perspective, from that pet parent who is banished to just sit in their car, where their pet gets just trotted off or gone in a carrier. The flip side of that is it's really hard to talk about a disease with a family when you can't read their facial expression or their body language, and you don't even hear anything, understandably, on the other end. So you can't gauge how that information is being received. Oddly, showing my age, decades ago when I first became board certified, the colleges talked about limiting the amount of veterinary specialists. They were convinced that we would oversaturate the market. And with COVID especially, it was evident that there is such a need for more general practitioners, veterinary specialists, veterinary technicians or nurses that we couldn't physically take care of all of the patients. COVID also made things harder because it increased the amount of work, right? You need to have a runner to go outside. Then someone's not at their car, or they're somewhere else because they can't sit there for 3 hours in your parking lot. And it takes so much longer. It takes more manpower when you actually have less manpower. The other thing that I realized is, clearly, obviously, I love animals. Most veterinarians do. But even if I wasn't a practicing veterinary oncologist, there are so many more things that I could do to help animals' lives and help people's lives. But I realized that what truly fades me day in and day out at my job is getting to interact with the families and understanding them. And that went out the window the minute that COVID hit, because you could not develop those strong bonds with people.
Hmm. Marianne, wait for the microphone's coming.
I unfortunately had a dog years ago with cancer and lymphoma and severe, but it was a hard decision to, are we going to give Scarlett chemotherapy? But at the time, and it was probably 12 years ago, it was that chemotherapy did not react the same way on dogs as people. It did, at least for the first year, it didn't make them sick. Is that still sort of true?
Yes, so in general, and I'm sorry about your dog, but In general, for chemotherapy in dogs, 85% do not get sick. For cats, 90% do not get sick. Right. Hmm. So it's a whole different philosophy. In terms of your dog or whomever else's dog, when you're struggling trying to make that decision, you will never go wrong, ever, as long as you always lead with your dog's best quality of life in mind, right? That decision might be different based on the length of time you're still with your pet. But if you always lead with your dog's best quality of life in mind, you will never, ever make the wrong decision. And say you're that, you know, 85% for your dog or 90% with your cat, and you decide to treat, great. But if your animal is one of the ones that gets sick and maybe a dose change can't help or some medication can't help, then it might be better to not treat, right? Because quality of life is the most important. I think you can use that measuring stick when it also comes time to say goodbye, right? Because as dog lovers, we never want to do that, make that decision one day too late, right? Now, we don't want to make it one day too early, but as long as we lead with their quality of life, you know, and sometimes as a veterinarian, I'll say, so, you know, is your dog eating? Oh, yeah, he's eating perfectly. And I'm like, well, is he eating his regular dog food? Oh, no, he hasn't had that in months. I have to hand feed him chicken, right? So you can't just ask that sort of basic question.
Right.
But in the book, in chapter 9, there's a list of questions. And it's just, there are just questions to get you to think. It's not if 7 of the 9 of them are positive, you should consider doing something. It's just to get you to think. I also don't believe that there is a wrong answer, right? Some people believe in euthanasia and other people don't, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should never go to someone who tells you what you should do. You know deep down what is right. And I think it's important to empower that voice in us, not the nasty one in the head, but the one deep inside. I think it's hard because we always want our dogs and our cats to live as long as possible, but their natural lifespan isn't that of ours. And, you know, when I was counseling my son at the time, who was just a young teen, I really do believe that dogs are placed in our lives at just the right moment, just when we need them the most, sometimes when we don't even realize that there is something that we need, but they end up filling this hole or this need inside us. And while I never want to lose one of my dogs, if I look back at each of them, they have each taught me and brought me something different.
Now, do you explore environmental issues, dietary issues, pesticides on lawns, all that stuff in with your patients in your practice?
So I'm the crazy next-door neighbor that literally pulls the weeds out of her grass and my husband rolls his eyes. There have been, unfortunately, environmental factors, you know, food factors. Correct, yes.
I have a funny story. I stopped spraying my lawn, and the gardener said, your husband won't like this. I've worked with him for years. He's going to be angry. I said, look, we're not spraying, so I don't know at what point. You know my husband. He came out one day. There's clover everywhere. And God bless him, he said, how did you do that? It's beautiful. I said,
Exactly.
So we had a very positive outcome that.
But like cats that live in households with smokers, right, because they're very fastidious and they groom, they have a much higher incidence of certain cancers than non-smokers. And you are so diligent, you keep raising your hand.
Hi. As a doctor, I'm sure you prepare yourself to meet with the dog or cat owner, the animal owner, in order to tell the family that the animal has cancer. So, because all doctors have to do that, there's a centering moment before you walk into that room and you say, all right, we need to have a talk here. So would you comment on how, before you had your diagnosis and went through your healing with your dog, you centered, and whether your own experience impacted on how you center yourself now with your families?
So I believe that knowledge is power, and that my job is to give that family as much information as I can so that they can make the best educated decision. Small little backstory. When I was a fourth-year veterinary student, I was in clinics following around a very senior veterinarian. And I often get asked, what was your most memorable or your most important lesson in veterinary school? And I remember the gentleman was giving bad news to this family. It had nothing to do with cancer. And everyone, the family was crying, and his white lab coat arms were just stiff down at his arms. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, that's horrible. And I got a little misty because of the compassion, right, that I had, or the empathy that I had for this family. And after they left, he pulled me in the back. He's like, Renee, come here, you know, come here. He's like, let me tell you. You know, after you do this for a few years, don't worry, you'll toughen up. It won't bother you. And I thought, oh my goodness, if it ever stops bothering me, then that's when I need to stop being a veterinarian, right? So back to your question, interestingly, and I don't actually share this with most anyone, so here's my, you know, 45 people that I'm sharing it with.
And the radio.
Yeah, and the radio, even better. My medical oncologist was much harsher in her delivery. I try to minimize the scars for my clients, right? And I had surgical scars, and they gave me ointments and all that stuff. In fact, you guys want to really know a secret? Nobody knows this. Once HarperCollins bought the book and they wanted to change the title. I totally understand for marketing purposes the title I chose wasn't appropriate, but my title was In Every Scar There Is a Story. See, you would have bought it, right? Thank you.
Yeah, I like
right.
that.
That's what I think too. They didn't like that. But it's true. But I don't think that they, or at least maybe one main person, tried to minimize my scars. It's a job where I cry most every week, but that's my release, you know, either that or carbs, so it's one or the other. But it's a great job.
I have a question. Do you have a spiritual or a mindfulness practice, that's something that you do to kind of recenter yourself regularly?
That's a great question. In part, really trying not to be funny, I can't watch something on TV or Netflix or in the movies that is difficult. I'm not even good with dramas. I truly need that sitcom, because every day I'm talking about mm-hmm. living and dying. You may not know this, but in veterinary medicine, we have one of the highest suicide rates. I know probably two handfuls of people that have died by suicide, especially during COVID. It was horrible. And so, you know, compassion fatigue became a much more common term for everyone. And we all know what compassion is, and what it really means, though, is to suffer with someone from emotional trauma, which is very different than burnout from a job, right? That might be you have a hard boss or you have a work overload or what have you, but that's not emotionally draining. For me, I think that it is so very important to have that pack mentality and to instill that in my team so that if there's something sad, we all talk about it instead of thinking, oh gosh, I'm just being soft and it's only affecting me. But I think it's also important that we celebrate that Fluffy got 3 years or got to go, you know, to Nantucket with them or Ocean House in the summer or what have you. And then I think, silly, but just little things. When you know you're going to have a really hard day, you buy the team lunch because everyone loves to look forward to, you know, good food, exactly, especially in the veterinary world. You play some music, stuff that helps us all.
There was a book many years ago. I lost a very dear friend in our early 30s to liver cancer. And
sorry.
There was a book I read then called Love, Medicine, and Miracles by Bernie Siegel. And I've never forgotten. It really, I don't know if he was an oncologist or a surgeon, but he talked about five things that he felt in his practice with humans that people did who really often beat incredible odds, the kind of diagnoses where they were told, get your affairs in order. And I probably won't remember them all. One was actually kind of accepting the diagnosis, you know, not saying, oh, I just don't have that, that's not true. One was making some sort of lifestyle change. No prescription of what it was, but some choice. I think it had to do with conscious intent. One was sort of consciously assessing your relationships. One was spiritual. I might have it all wrong. But one was humor, to your point. That was a big one. Finding the things that make you laugh.
Right.
And I thought that was so interesting because we are not inclined to do that in crisis. It is just not at all what we want to do, but I'm glad to hear you say that. I think we have time for another question or two. Yes?
I wonder if in your experience, if you've ever treated a therapy dog or a therapy animal that with some significant condition. Because I know you shared with us that physically, the animals don't lose their olfactory function and, you know, they don't lose that much weight. But I wonder emotionally, would a therapy animal suffering itself still have that capacity to fulfill that function?
That is a wonderful question. I have treated numerous therapy animals. I've treated many animals that work for the CNI and still guide their impaired person, and they never seem to miss a beat. There was a story one time in New York City. I don't know, I think it made it in like one of the New York Post type magazines or newspapers, and it was about a person who was blind and their guide dog, but that person had no idea that her guide dog was blind.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, that's interesting.
I fully believe, and you'll see if you read the book, that I believe dogs have this sixth sense about them. I think that they see us better than we see each other, sometimes better than we know ourselves. One of the chapters, the first chapter, not the introduction, but the first chapter is Daisy. And I don't know if I should do it, if it's a spoiler alert or not.
That's all right. You can do that.
I can do it?
Yeah.
All right. So in comes this mother, and she has a Cocker Spaniel, and she is pushing what I finally realized was a wheelchair. And there is a 9-year-old girl named Kathy. The family adopted her from Indonesia when she was just a baby. She's unable to sit up, so she's held up with safety belts. She cannot speak. She cannot eat by mouth. She has a gastric feeding tube. But she loves Disney princesses. And so the Cocker Spaniel came in as Elsa from Frozen, which was her favorite. Now, Kathy had an ear-to-ear smile that would light up this entire room. A lovely, lovely girl. So, of course, they say, Doc, you got to save the dog because this is, you know, no pressure. And the Cocker Spaniel had lymphoma. She lived for 3 years, did great. The Cocker Spaniel never left that girl's side. Despite Kathy not being able to speak, the dog knew exactly what she was saying. But the biggest kicker was that Kathy, in addition to all of her other special needs, had uncontrolled epilepsy. And the dog, Daisy, without any formal training whatsoever, became a seizure alert dog for that family. Daisy herself actually had epilepsy as well. Hers was, you know, thankfully able to be, you know, controlled or maintained with medication. But she had that magical ability. And for those of you who never saw Frozen, right, Elsa is this princess who is able to manipulate ice and snow to make the world a better, happier place. And that's exactly what Daisy the Cocker Spaniel was able to do for her family.
Wow.
This will probably sound weird, but when you mentioned Malcolm Gladwell, I was listening to his podcast, Revisionist History, and he has once on The Dog Will See You Now, and it's about training of dogs to identify cancer, mainly prostate, and also they train them to identify COVID. Do dogs identify with being sick or other dogs being sick? I mean, I'm just...
100%.
Okay.
Yes. Think of it, right? You saw the commercials for beagles checking for bed bugs. They are training dogs for prostate cancer, for other types of cancers, lung cancers, COVID, things like that. They really do dogs. Or... for veterans that have PTSD, right? Therapists are great, but sometimes a slobbery, four-legged dog is the best therapist in town.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question, and then we'll have an after party.
I don't have a question, but you made a comment that resonated so strongly with me. I just want to thank you. And you talked about the non-judgmental quality that dogs exhibit. And I have, I've had a couple of therapy dogs. The one that I work with currently works in very emotionally charged environments. So she works for the Rhode Island court system, primarily family court. And she also works at a homeless shelter. And the impact that non-judgmental, especially with these folks who are being judged and are, there's just so much that's so critical toward them, that the fact that there's something that exhibits such unconditional love and non-judgmental qualities toward them is so incredibly powerful, and honestly, I have seen it be life-changing. So thank you. Thank you for acknowledging that.
Oh,
and it is incredible to watch.
This past weekend, I was down in Wilmington, North Carolina, keynote for this nonprofit called Pause for People. And when I was first asked, I sort of looked at their website, and I'm like, sure, whatever. But I really didn't get the impact until I got there. And they train dogs, they've trained thousands, for children with special needs or veterans with special needs. And they had past graduates come from all over the United States. They also had a local fireman, so this gets to your point exactly. They have a program, therapy dogs, for the fire department, because they said, The gentleman was saying, you know, we always go and you think it's just about fires, but we actually do so much more. And there are a lot of things that don't end well. And it really weighs so heavily on their emotional psyche. And so they have almost like this little hotline where they call pause for people, they rally their troops. And he said, without fail, within the hour, the people bring these therapy dogs down to the fire station. The people don't say anything. They don't need to. But the dogs do so much good in healing them that it has made a vast difference in their lives.
Thank you, Renee. This was amazing. Really, really amazing. Thank you all.
Thank you for joining us for this special broadcast of the Ocean House Authors Series with Deborah Goodrich Royce. Please tune in each month as we'll bring you a new Ocean House Authors Series highlighting nationally best-selling and award-winning authors in a salon-style conversation. Hosted by Ocean House owner, actress, and best-selling author, Deborah Goodrich Royce. WCRI is pleased to be partnering with the Ocean House to bring you this ongoing series highlighting the best and the brightest of the literary world. Thank you once again for joining us. And in the words of Margaret Atwood, in the end, we all become stories.